Hi. Just for information, this talk is listed in the programming track. It's actually mostly a game design talk. There's a lot of technical information in it as well, but just to set people's expectations. And the conference has asked me to remind people to turn off their cell phones and to fill out the survey forms that they're handing out at the door after the talk. So I'm Jay Stelly. I'm a senior engineer at Valve, and today we're going to talk about physical gameplay in Half-Life 2. So when we started Half-Life 2, we had kind of a vision for all the things we wanted to bring to our game. And I mean, Half-Life was a big success, and it afforded us a lot of opportunity to go forward and create. We had all the resources we needed to create a game that we couldn't have created before. So we looked at a lot of different technologies and a lot of different things to bring to the game experience, and physics was one of the things that we thought was really cool. So kind of, you know, go back in your mind to 1999, and we were all looking at this physically based animation, and it was just amazingly cool visually to see, you know, objects tumbling over realistically and ragdolls and all of those features that people were doing with physics simulators back then. And so there was this obvious visual payoff of bringing physics into your game. And we kind of knew everybody was going to go after this. I mean, people were writing simulators all over. Everybody was talking about it at GDC that year. And we were looking at various people's technology. But really, it seemed to us at the time that the opportunity was to integrate that with your gameplay. That, you know, if we made a game that just had stuff falling over and ragdolls, that was going to be cool. It was going to add to our game, but it also wasn't going to really differentiate the product from other people's games. So we were looking at that being the primary focus of our efforts in physics, and it's really both a game design problem and a technical problem. So today I'm kind of going to talk about working on both sides of that problem and talk about some of the things we did with game design to kind of overcome the lack of reference material for physics at the time in gameplay, and some of the technical problems that we had to fight. So also, given that this audience is a lot of programmers, I'm guessing, when we get to the questions at the end, if you want to ask any, you know, I'll go into any kind of detail about how stuff in Half-Life 2 is implemented. If I don't cover that in the talk. So like I was saying before, our high-level strategy was to invest in the gameplay. So we tried to take on the constraint early on of not building the simulator and not adding any features to the simulator. And later on it became necessary, but generally we kept to that constraint all the way through the project. Differentiating the product by the depth of gameplay integration, not by incremental simulator features or quality. I mean, you ask yourself at that time, like, why would we go out and build our own physics technology? And the obvious answers are, we think we can do a higher quality or better performance simulator than what was out there. And that even if we succeeded at that, that didn't seem to have the benefit to our customers as going into, you know, all the way into integrating it with the gameplay and spending the same amount of development effort on that as we may have on building technology. So we thought that's the bigger opportunity. And that means we're going to have to, you know, do a lot of engineering work in tools and solutions in the game design space. So just want to give you kind of an overview of how Half-Life 2, kind of how physics came into Half-Life 2, just to give you the rough timeline of what was going on there. And we'll drill into a couple of pieces of this because I think they're interesting. So like I was saying, back in 1999, you know, we were talking about we want to make our world more immersive and interactive for the player. You know, we still had a lot of static geometry and static bitmaps in Half-Life. We wanted to have a lot less of that in Half-Life 2, and physics was one of the things we were going to bring forward. I mean, we looked at investments in AI and character, acting, you know, animation, behavior, emotion, things like that as well. We're not going to talk about here, but you know, our heads were full of all these ideas about what Half-Life 2 was going to be. So we looked at the physics demos, and it was really inspiring stuff. And the generated animation and the opportunity for player freedom that they represented were really attractive. So we had tons of ideas at that point. We licensed physics simulator back then from this company called IPON. They had the best technology at the time, in our opinion, and you know, started going to work. So then we kind of took some time for the game designers to internalize physics. We built a bunch of prototypes, and we built a bunch of design tools and game logic there. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit more in a second. Then we did a ton of gameplay mechanics experiments. I mean, we had all these little games you could play with physics, and many of them are now fully realized in Half-Life 2, and you've played them. But, you know, they all started off as these little prototypes that various people built. We solved some technical problems there. Then we did this kind of cut and focus pass where we looked at all the gameplay we had and cut it down to the things that we thought were going to work. And I'm going to talk about how we went through that from a design perspective. And we had to solve even more technical problems. And then we kind of incrementally delivered a stable physics environment for our game designers. I guess I think that's kind of a key decision. Looking at the game, you know, the technology was unfamiliar to the designers, and they had a lot of learning to do. And it really was important to bring it in incrementally into their process, right, a little bit at a time. And I'd like to give you an example of that. So the goal was to have valuable features each time we delivered physics into our engine. So we had a running engine right from the start. I mean, we took the engine from Half-Life and completely transformed it over the life of the project. But each time we put in physics, the first one just had the tool chain for collisions with our environment and our art assets. And so you could place in static geometry, and it all had the proper physics collision. And you could build these dynamic objects in Hammer, our game level editor, that would collide with that environment. And so you could kick them around with forces, you could knock them over, you know, simple things like that. Then the next deliverable added the ability to do the same things with models that were built in other packages like Max or XSI or Maya, and a few more pieces of game logic so people could hook up constraints and springs and that kind of stuff. But it was still in the game design space. Players couldn't interact with any of this stuff with collision. Like the players didn't collide at that point. But we built a bunch of things that were fun to knock over. And you know, a bunch of interesting visual, you know, animation at that point. Then the next deliverable was adding the player character controller to the game, so the player was actually physically represented in the world, and you can bump into things and knock them over, stand on things. Then later we added ragdolls, and so on and so on and so on. So just the idea there is to you know, introduce physics in chunks to the game design process and not like overwhelmed with, okay, the game, you know, here's the whole technology, go digest it, go design a game. And really that was just really valuable. We got very good at physics in these little pieces without having to, you know, think about it as a whole. And so after that we went into the process of polishing and shipping the game. So this is kind of an interesting thing. There weren't really other games that were doing physics, certainly not in our genre, in a way that was relevant to us. So there was this phase where basically our designers had to build a bunch of little games in our game and play them to kind of get an idea of what we were going to bring. I mean, it seems like as game designers, most people get their primary, you know, inspiration from other things they've seen or played, and really kind of doing this in our own game was the way we sort of figured out what we were going to build. And so also, you know, I kind of went through the timeline. I mean, you know, that you guys know that that was back in 1999, and Half-Life 2 shipped in 2004. So, you know, we did take a lot of time early on to kind of explore this stuff. I was at Will Wright's talk yesterday, and he kind of really made me feel better about it. So if I were doing Will Wright's talk, I could put up the timeline of like the age of, you know, the known universe, and it's like 100 billion years. And he zoomed in on that timeline and said, okay, this is how long, you know, the Earth cooled out of material ejected from the star. And you know, he went through this whole explanation of that. And he, you know, after you get to that kind of perspective, you know, a game that took 6 years just doesn't seem that long anymore. So I felt a lot better about that. I kind of thank Will Wright for that. But we did these really great things early on. I mean, it was kind of this really fun playground when enough kind of critical mass came in. And I just wanted to go and tell you guys about some of these things. And originally I intended to come in and demo these things, which I thought would be great. But the assets were so stale that I struggled with them in the old trees, and I couldn't get these running well enough for it to be cool for you guys. But like one of the first things, one of our designers took the satchel charges from Half-Life, and there were these little mines you could throw out, and then you have a button, and later you could blow them up, if you guys remember that from the game. And, you know, it was like a parking lot in City 17 full of zombies, and he built these giant, obvious basketball hoops all around the parking lot. And so one of the first games was zombie basketball, where you'd leave the satchel charges around and kind of lead the zombies over them and try to make points. And he had little game logic triggers that would drive a scoreboard and crazy stuff like that. We had this watermelon skeet shooting course where there was this giant kind of contraption that would feed, you'd pull a lever and a watermelon roll and feed into a thing that would like catapult it out, and you could shoot it and it would break into chunks. And the watermelon from that is in the game in a few places, and you can break it. But there was a little thing where you could bring Barney in, and he would, when you pulled the lever, he would draw his gun and shoot watermelons with you. So, you know, we're just having fun with it. And one of the more, a little bit more serious experiments we did was this thing called the glue gun. And this was kind of the first place where we were really looking at what the player's inputs were into the game. So we made this weapon that would shoot out a beam that was kind of like a flexible fishing rod, and you could grab objects at a point and pull them around and then reel them in. And you could the secondary fire on it, since that's the UI in our game, would allow you to place a little pellet of glue on an object, and you could place another one somewhere else and then drag the objects over, and the glue would attract each other and form a constraint. So you could build all kinds of contraptions out of the glue gun as a player. So this was really, really cool and drove us in a bunch of interesting directions. And sort of the original idea was that this was about extending the puzzle gameplay of Half-Life. So we were going to have building puzzles where you could, you know, put together a bridge to cross some impassable area, things like that. And what we actually ended up using it for were more of these kind of physics playground things. The Danger Ted playset was an interesting one. So we did, if you guys played the game, you know, in City 17 there are all these people around, and we had a casting call for the face textures and models that we were doing for the game, and there was one of our artists, the guy who made the headcrabs, in fact, Ted Backman, who got into the cut for faces on the characters, and so he was one of the characters in the game, and one of our game designers, Steve Bond, thought that it would be really fun to take Ted and make him a rag doll, and then take the glue gun and glue him to an old busted out car, and then glue some propane canisters to the sides, and knock the ends off of them so that they shot out with thrust, and launched him up into the air. So we came up with all these things inside. You know, people added more objects to it and more things you could build. So this is this really cool experiment with building. And another similar one is one we kind of affectionately called Toilet Crossing, but it was more of a serious game thing where you had to, you know, one of these puzzles we were talking about building to extend the Half-Life puzzle gameplay, where you had a bar going across a chasm with a sliding hook on it, and there was a collection of junk all around, and you could build something for you to ride on that would shoot across the chasm, kind of like your own personal zip line. But it really got its character when people put the toilet props in there. And so for style, you had to mount the toilet somewhere on your contraption and ride on the toilet as you went across. So these were all fun experiments, and you know, they kind of helped us figure out the gameplay experience. And really, the glue gun was the most promising thing in this space. And it later became the gravity gun. And I'll kind of go into reasons why. So the thing to take away with this is, it's like if you're bringing new technology into your game and you don't have kind of the reference, you know, The process we used was really creating our own reference and kind of playing around with it. And another thing that's cool about this is that, you know, this experience was really fun for us, but we couldn't really polish all this stuff to the level we'd want to put it in our box and say, you know, this is our product. So we did take at least the glue gun. I put the code for it in the SDK, and at least one developer shipped out a mod called Gary's Mod that used that and went in all kinds of great directions with it. So if you haven't played Gary's Mod and you're looking for a little bit of this experience, I think it's like the closest thing out there to that. So it was really cool when we saw that. It was exactly like the kind of thing I was hoping when I just put the source file in there and said, hey, maybe people who download our SDK would like this, you know. So zooming back out to our timeline, so we did those experiments and we went a little further into gameplay mechanic experiments, and these were things that were all kind of seriously candidates to put into the game. So at this point, we had a lot of questions, right? We have all these kind of promising gameplay mechanics. They're based on physics. They all need lots of work. I mean, you don't have a lot of polish at this point. There are a lot of technical problems, but they all have some fundamental thing about them that's cool and fun. So we need to decide, you know, how many of these do we need? I mean, how many of these make up our game, right? And which ones are the best, and how do we compare them? And, you know, turning them into shippable gameplay, what does that look like? How do we, you know, how do we talk about that? How do we do that intentionally? We were kind of bringing more engineering into our game design process, I guess is the thing that ultimately happened. And I think the same thing was true in Half-Life when we formed the first Cabal. We got a lot more analytical about our game design at that point, and I think for the better. And I guess I'll develop this a little bit more first. So I guess one thing to look at is in game design, I think a good insight we had is that you can reduce a bunch of it to this notion of training and testing. So really, you can think of your game design as like a bunch of instructions that tell the player, okay, here's how you go out in this world we've created and have fun. So it's my job to teach you about all the things you need to know to go do something fun in the game. And then I have to design some stuff that's fun. And I also need, you know, a good aesthetic. But there's a bunch of the stuff that's a little bit more objective, right? It's like, these are the things we think are going to be fun. And then here's what the player needs to learn in order to do them. And then here are the parts of the games where we allow you to do them in the fun way, or we require you to do them in order to move on. So that thing was a lot more objective and a lot more evaluatable and measurable. So I kind of came up with this reduction of that, which, of course, this isn't everything game design is, but, you know, the idea of just taking this piece of it and saying, okay, we can be more objective about this. We want to do a set of player experience that train the player with specific skills and knowledge, and then we allow or require them to demonstrate that skill or knowledge because that's fun. And we want to present it with style because that's the game design aesthetic. So really the idea here is that there are a bunch of things that are really engineering, and you want to aggressively go find them in your game design and distill them out and do them intentionally like that. You don't want to ignore the aesthetic parts of it, but you want to take advantage of the fact that a bunch of this stuff can be more analytical and more intentional, right? And you can go directly toward your game design goals in a kind of measurable way, right? I mean, that's kind of the benefit of engineering. It's a structure for solving problems. So, you know, you ask yourself questions like, what are the things you can measure or analyze, you know, objectively? So these are just kind of the things that you do when you're doing engineering. And, I mean, if you guys doing game design or engineering, I mean, you recognize this process, right? I assume most people have done some amount of it in game design, but I guess the key thing I'm saying is like, you know, intend to distill out the stuff you're doing in game design and make it engineering, separate that part from the stuff that feels more just like aesthetic and style. So you want to define your success, you know, identify your constraints. You know, you still have to generate ideas, you still have to be creative, but you want to come up with some way to analyze your solutions, right? You want to model them or measure them. You build prototypes. It's important that you do tests and measure your success. And sometimes you re-examine your constraints so that you know, hey, I need to have a broader way to solve these problems. So to the extent that these things can be objective, you know, it becomes easier to analyze and test them. And the stuff that's more subjective, really, we just use playtesting as a way to test success. And if you didn't see it, David Spire and Brian Jacobson gave a talk on Wednesday about our playtesting process in way more detail than I'm going to go into. But you can look at that in the proceedings. Let's go on to the next thing. So once you've kind of defined a bunch of your gameplay as this, it's much easier to see why each piece of game design is in your design. So you can do things like, okay, I want the player to have this experience. Well, what are all the things they need to know? Okay, they need to know this, this, and this, and this. Okay, well, they don't know all four of those things yet, so there's no way I want them to learn all four at the time that we're actually, you know, saying, well, you have to do this in order to succeed. So I go back into my game design and kind of solve backwards for building up these requirements, right? And there are examples of that in Half-Life 2, like some really simple ones of at the beginning of the game, we ask you to, you know, just alone, there's no pressure on you, stack a box underneath a window and climb on it to get out of the window. And we just want to train that one skill in isolation. And then again, right after that, we ask you to pick up this can and put it in the trash can. And you don't have to do that one like you have to do the box, but it's another opportunity to practice that. I mean, just a simple thing, because later on we're going to require you to just know that and combine it with some other skill. So that's just like a really simple example of this, but the important thing is thinking about the gameplay like that and just getting objective about, okay, I have this experience I want them to have. Let me just enumerate it and go back and make sure that I've succeeded at doing the game design. And I don't want to imply that we were just totally rigorous about doing this everywhere and we made all these lists and documents of how that worked. But anytime we had a problem in game design, these were the first questions we asked, right? We play-tested something, it went badly. We're like, well, okay, this went badly. Have we succeeded here? Did we actually teach the player how to do everything they need to do, you know, to get here? What are they actually being required to do? And how much they're being required to, like, learn on the spot is kind of a good metric for the difficulty, right? So you kind of learn things about, you know, difficulty, about how to compare these gameplay mechanics. You also learn how to cut. I mean, if something isn't actually used later in the game, it's not necessary, or you get to a point where you want the player to do this and you find out that it doesn't actually have any requirements outside of it, you know, it becomes an isolated thing on the edge of your game design. And that's probably the most likely thing you should cut. And that sort of leads me into the next point. Oh, and this is just, as you don't remember the picking up the can. Just a real quick overview. Like, you guys, I'm sure, do this all the time, but, like, how you train these things. Like, thinking about this is just, like, here's a list of things I can go use to solve these problems. I've got to train these four skills. Okay, I go into my bag of how I do that, and I've kind of covered this stuff on the previous slide. I guess the interesting thing here is just differentiating between something that's an explicit test, so you have to perform this skill or have this knowledge in order to progress in the game, and then later on you can just assert, okay, the player already knows this, so we can do whatever we want with that skill now. So there's also, I guess, one other thing to note here is, like, sometimes you do that with these forced choices where it kind of, like, the stacking the box, it's sort of this, the player has to go do it, but it's really forced on them, right? They can't progress further in the game without doing it. But it feels like player choice when they do it. I mean, they walk over and they pick which box they want to use or which object, and they put it on the window. And so you're kind of always selling these things to make it feel more natural, because sometimes you really have to get to that and say, okay, I really need the player to do this here. I'm going to force them to do it before they can go on. But this gets back into the aesthetic. You really need to do that with style. So some other things that make training more difficult, just to go through a few of them. You know, combat or you know, danger, peril that the player's in, really not inducive to training. If you're requiring the player to, you know, learn something that you want them to learn while this is going on, it's a lot harder for them to learn. We learned that the hard way several times. But I mean, the basic idea is if you're forcing the player to make decisions, they're going to react. They're going to rely on the stuff that they already know. You know, you're saying, okay, make a decision now or die, right? It's like, oh, what do I already know? So another thing you want to do is go through and look for opportunities to improve your training, right? What I was talking before about selling force choices with style. Making it clear that it's okay to experiment. I mean, this was really key. There are a bunch of points in the game where we just take the pressure off. We put you somewhere and maybe in a bit of story. And, you know, it's clear you can go and play with stuff. And that's kind of key to you learning stuff or practicing. So a couple examples of that. I mean, the simplest one is we do some training when you first meet Dog at Eli's lab. So you get into this sequence where he lets you play pitch and catch. You get the gravity gun, and you guys toss objects back and forth. And there's kind of this entertaining animation going on. But really, you're learning how to aim the gravity gun, how it reacts when you throw stuff. You know, you're learning a bunch of useful stuff. But there's no pressure on you. I mean, you can, like, throw the thing not to Dog and see what happens. And you can try out a bunch of different things. So it's kind of like the game is really making it clear to you at that point. There are no consequences for doing something silly. Go ahead and try and experiment. I think that's really important. And we learned that story is completely orthogonal to training. There's no obstacle there. It's not like combat. People are happily paying attention or listening to a story while they're also like trying something or learning something. And so kind of being more objective about that and looking at what's going on, what's the context under which I'm training the player, and knowing that if you have some combat thing, you can make it a story thing if you feel like the space is going to be dead otherwise. That's a useful thing. So this is an example of like some experimentation and a forced choice. We kind of sell the style here. So you guys remember in Ravenholm, if you played the game. If you haven't, it's this town that's overrun with zombies, and we have the gravity gun there, and we give you a bunch of things to throw around with the gravity gun. And one of the things that came up during the course of designing Ravenholm was this idea that objects would have behaviors that only became apparent when you interacted with them with the gravity gun. And one of the most successful versions of that were the saw blades. So the idea with the gravity gun, if you haven't played the game, is you can pick up objects and launch them at your enemies. It's a, you know, it's part of the combat experience. I mean, it does a lot of other things. But these saw blades were a weapon that they align themselves in kind of blade cutting position, and you throw them and they spin through the air. Right, so they're smart. They know how to do that when you pick them up with the gravity gun. So we introduce them in this kind of this tool shed that you come to, and it's pretty low pressure. I mean, there are some zombies outside, but you've already dealt with them, and there's a bunch of stuff in here, and it's clear like you can knock stuff around with the gravity gun and play with stuff in here. So we're saying, okay, it's fine to do an experiment, and then this is kind of like selling this forced choice. So there's a doorway that you have to go to that's blocked by saw blades, and you need to pull one out, so we kind of require you to pick one up so that you learn, hey, you should pick these up, and they can be stuck in the wall. And then there's another one here where it's not required, but if you pick it up, you know, it's got a zombie hanging from it, and the zombie falls to the floor. And so we're kind of suggesting that, you know, maybe you should throw these at the zombies, right? And so the very next thing that happens, this is the, you know, the thing that it's, you see the saw blade up above. There are a couple of them locked in the wall in the doorway here, and you kind of can't get through the doorway without picking it up. And so you grab one of them, and oh, a zombie comes right up in front of you, right? And, you know, hopefully, if our game design is working well, the first thing you do is throw that saw blade at the zombie. You cut him in half, and now we've walked you through this process of, like, we've taught you what you need to know, because we've taught you about the gravity gun when you were playing catch with Dog, and you can throw stuff, and we've taught you about the saw blades just in this room, and now we've completed the training, and now you're having fun throwing saw blades, chopping zombies in half. It's really great. So I guess I've alluded to a few of these things, but haven't really explained this. And this is a really dense slide, so let me walk you through it. We talked about comparing gameplay mechanics and making trade-offs in the game design space. So we came up with this idea of, you know, we're asking the question, what can I measure about game design, right? What can I measure about gameplay? And we ended up developing this idea of player value metric. I mean, obviously, the most important thing about a gameplay mechanic is the value it delivers to the player. So how would you go about measuring that or analyzing that? And this is kind of the process for that. So, I guess the first thing is probably to talk about is the second thing on the list. There's a limit to the number of things you can train in a game, right? I mean, if you think of the game as all this training and testing, you're packing all the stuff into the player's head as you go. And, I'm teaching you about saw blades, and I'm teaching you about the gravity gun, and I'm teaching you about picking up boxes, and I'm teaching you about fighting with a machine gun, and beating stuff with a crowbar over the course of the game. And you can't just do that forever, right? At some point, the player's like, I'm overwhelmed with all this stuff. Why is it all important? So each piece of skill or knowledge needs to have value to the player, or you should cut it from your game, right? That's easy. And there's a limit of the things you can train in the game. So obviously, you want to have like the minimum number of things you actually need, right? Or you want to have things that have the most value. So what does the most value mean? Well, anytime that skill or knowledge interacts with another gameplay mechanic or another skill, it increases the value of both, right? You're telling the player, hey, this is another way that this is important. You should know it. And so requiring it to pass a test, right, that increases the value to the player. It says, this is an important skill that you're learning. This is just a way you can go back and measure, you can assign a number to how important each skill, each gameplay mechanic is to the player. And this is a really great way to do reasoning, right? I mean, at a couple of points, we did spreadsheets of this stuff and said, okay, what are all the skills we're training? Let's come up with a number for this. Let's compare them. Let's look where opportunities are to have these things interact with each other. And why haven't we ever made the gravity gun and the Jeep do something together? We asked some questions like that. So these relationships together kind of form this economy, and you can analyze it and optimize it and do engineering on it, right? And so at Valve, we call this design economy, and it's just a process and a terminology that I think was really useful just in discussions, right? It sets a framework for people to talk about something, and it's not, like I was saying before with the other parts of that, this distilling engineering out of your game design. By itself, this isn't just a recipe for game design, but it's a really useful tool for directly solving game design problems. So to give you some examples of what we did with design economy, I mean, I told you before, so we just sometimes made the big matrix and said, all right, have we done an interaction between these two things? Because that'll increase the value of them, right? That'll be a more economical design. And that resulted in stuff like the gravity gun being used to flip the Jeep over. When we thought of that, we were like, oh, why didn't we think of this? You've got this problem with vehicles and games where they flip over and, what do you do about it? Well, maybe there's a magical reset that happens or something like that. And it's really great to realize that, oh, hey, we can just flip it over with the gravity gun, and that makes the gravity gun better too. Another example is the enemies, the manhacks. They're like these spinning saw blades that fly around and attack you, and the scanners just hovering around, shining a light in your face, taking your picture, and giving information to other AIs. Early on, the same thing. The gravity gun kind of was the most intense version of this, where we just looked down and really aggressively pursued all the options because we realized this was a really valuable thing in our game. So let's go do everything with that makes sense, right? So given this, we're going to make it really valuable, right? And so we added things like that, like, oh, now you can grab those manhacks. Once you get the gravity gun, we can fight them again. Because before, you're kind of fighting them with the crowbar, and now you have the gravity gun. If you can pull them out of the air and, like, throw them against the wall or something, we can reuse the manhacks, and you already understand them, and you can play them again, but you get this new gameplay where you're more powerful, and we can combine them with other enemies. So we did that, and the same thing with the scanners. We added a power-up to the scanner, so if you kill them, you get a battery, and did the same thing with them. So, again, this process is leading us to those. Or the roller mines, another case of that, where we had these enemies that would originally would just roll toward you and seek you, and we kind of stealth train you about them by a dog has his ball, and you see, like, it can, it's a ball that's going to chase after you. You don't know that later on it's going to be your enemy. But the idea for those was they would roll up to you and explode when they touched you. And so the game was like, don't let the roller mines touch you. And that's not the way they shipped in the game, and not just for design economy reasons, but you know, that just turned out to not be a lot of fun. When you failed, the roller mines would all blow up, and then the experience was over. And we started trying out different things, some behaviors that aren't fully realized, like when you throw them into water, they explode. So that's a way you can dispose of them. And you can do that in the coast, but it's not really like trained and required. It's probably a candidate for something that, you know, could have been cut from our game. But we have all the houses where the roller mines are, and that was kind of the real first success of you're having the experience we wanted of like using the gravity gun to throw stuff and block a door so the roller mine can't get to you, and you know, the roller mines like fall through holes in the ceiling or come in through a window or something like that, or you can throw them out the window to kind of get rid of them and escape them. And that's kind of the experience that really gelled about those. But after we had that core gameplay, we started looking at our economy for them and saying, oh, you know, we're not really using these enough. We haven't made them important or valuable enough. So then we added the whole concept of them interacting with the car and like latching themselves onto the car, and hey, you can pull them off with the gravity gun, right? And they can eventually start disrupting your car with their electrical attacks. And that came out of this kind of thinking, right? So it's this, once you get the desire to go and add value to all the gameplay mechanics that are working, this is just sort of a recipe for like directly going in that direction, right? Think about in that process, getting into the you know, getting into that method is really useful. And so it's not about like trying to make a table of all the numbers as much as it is about internalizing that process. So an example of optimizations, just to do really fast here, we had one of the weapons in the game, you know, it's a primary and secondary fire, and it's a rifle that the Combine soldiers have. And then there were these power systems in the game that you were going to manipulate, and there were also these things we called super balls, which were at the end of the game, you were going to throw with the gravity gun after it got powered up. And kind of at that point when we were building the end of the game, we realized that we could probably have used these things earlier in the game. And we look back at the alt fire of the Combine rifle and these power puzzles. We even had a communications tower puzzle, which was just totally an orphan thing. You know, like I was saying, it was like, we need to cut this. It's not important enough. And we said, hey, we can actually make all these the same thing. And so by making them all the same thing, they're all that one thing is now more valuable, right? So it was an optimization on our economy of design. So fewer elements that do more things are more valuable than a lot of elements that only do one thing, right? And so that's the same kind of relationship we're talking about here. It's really useful. So now we're getting into that's kind of like what we were going through with game design and how we kind of refined our ideas. But you know, we were still making Half-Life, and after we had all these experiments, we realized that some of them weren't really extending the core gameplay of Half-Life. And even though we thought the glue gun was kind of taking the puzzle experience from Half-Life forward, I mean, it was a weapon, and weapons really need to extend your core combat gameplay, right? I mean, that's kind of the point of that. I mean, we don't have so many puzzles all the time that, you know, if every puzzle in the game was solved by the glue gun, that was going to do some damage to the core puzzle gameplay in Half-Life. From Half-Life. So we really started rethinking, like, the other thing is how these relate to our game and our genre. And this is when the glue gun kind of changed into the gravity gun, where we said, you know, we had this other idea for just being able to pull things at a distance and push on things with a weapon. And maybe there's more leverage in that and using that in combat. And, you know, you could pull something and have it fall on your enemies or push something and use it as cover. And, you know, one of our designers says, or you pick them up and, you know, use it as a weapon, and made the prototype of the gravity gun. And we really knew right away that this is the thing we should be doing for the physics weapon, right? And went back and factored that into our designs. So there's like some simple things that are implied by that. You need like collisions that cause damage, and you need the players and the NPCs to be able to use physics objects as cover, right, to get physics into your core combat gameplay. And we know we need to break things with the crowbar, and that should all be physical too. And we need some physics that extends that core puzzle gameplay if we're not going to do the glue gun. I guess the other thing about the glue gun is all the things that were really fun were this totally other game that implied all these constraints. I mean, one of the things that was was really harsh with the glue gun is that when we started playtesting it, people would glue barrels to the wall and build their own stairway up to wherever they wanted to go. They're just like, oh, here's something, I'd stand on that, let me put another thing, you know, and they have their own little stepladder up out of any of our maps. And so our level designers are like, hey, I love this glue gun, but what do I do? People can go anywhere they want in their map, and, you know, controlling the space of the player is like one of my tools for making things work, and I don't know what to do. I'm designing a totally different game now. So that was another thing where, you know, it really isn't fitting in with Half-Life 2. I still think there's a whole game to be built with the glue gun, and at least, you know, Gary's mod is a great thing out in that direction. So now we get to the point where we have, you know, I've said we've done this cut and focus pass, and we've got to bring these gameplay ideas all the way to shipping. And so integrating physics with a game with, you know, this established game genre is actually pretty difficult. Physics is like this intuitive thing that most people understand how it works, but it doesn't just work for a bunch of technical reasons. You know, you put stuff together, and there are things like, you know, it's all the dynamics right now are at least in you know, 1999, when we're starting with this, are based on rigid bodies, right? And lots of things aren't rigid, and that, you know, that causes some problems. You know, there are a bunch of things that imply that you know a lot about physics, and in order to realize your design, and you know, all of our designers and programmers kind of understand how physics, you know, works in the real world, but like there are subtle things about how the simulator is different from that they don't understand until they learn a lot. So that makes things difficult. And a lot of game logic is done with this kind of layered rule approach. So you say, okay, here's the rule, right? It's a really simple thing. And then there are problems with that rule. And so you say, well, here's another rule that makes that work out. And maybe you add a few more, right? And at least we do that a lot in our game designs. I assume everybody else does. But when you start to get to a system like physics, there are all kinds of simulation variables underneath those rules. And when you start exerting control over that simulation to implement those rules, you run into a lot of problems. Changing this variable also changes this other one, and you didn't really want to, and you know that's pretty complicated. So let's talk about a little bit of that. So the design interface to physics is, you know, is not obvious. There are these problems about, I want to build this machine, but I have to decompose it into blocks of physics, and that one's not too bad. You know, we teach designers about rigid bodies and constraints, and they can kind of build a dynamic system. But then it has to also be physically plausible. I mean, you know, I went into one of our designers' office where he was building this machine, and he couldn't get the motion he wanted. And really, you know, the physics thing is providing this animation for him, right? He could have hand-authored the animation, but physics was going to look a lot better. And, you know, the end result was, hey, your system isn't symmetric and stable. You need to have a counterweight on this thing that you're driving with a motor, or else the system's going to oscillate. And, you know, that's like not something you're used to when you're just trying to get some animation, right? So, you know, hey, hang an invisible piece of concrete off the end of this, and it should be about this far and weigh this much, because I'm going to do the calculation that, you know, balances out the inertia that you're moving around on this thing. So there are all these design decisions you want to make that imply calculations when you get into physics. So you say, I want this part of this machine to spin at this speed. And, you know, that implies a bunch of calculations about what's connected to it in the machine and how is it actually coupled. Or I want the player to walk out on this plank, and I want it to be stable enough to support the player, but only until he gets here, and then it's going to fall, right? And the designer just wants to say that in some design language, right? And so some of this we solved by, you know, like I was saying before, we delivered the technology incrementally, and so they learned about some of this stuff one step at a time, and so they didn't try to do everything. They're only trying to do the one problem. Some of this we solved by like packaging up design controls on physics as gameplay, game logic objects. And some of it we solved by having a physics expert, you know, a programmer who learns a lot about the physics system, come in and say, what are you trying to do? How are you using the simulator? Oh, actually, you're turning this tuning parameter for damping because you want to move this thing to move slower, but you've got to connect it in the system. What you really want is to increase the mass of this object, you know, or or you want to increase the friction in this joint. You know, so like going and finding the right variables in the simulation to change is still not a super well-solved problem. And then somebody coming in and doing the calculations for you, right? Somebody who took statics and dynamics in college is going to have a lot easier time going up and saying, oh, yeah, you just need to calculate this. Oh, you want a torque here? Okay, so I'm going to write the equation, solve it. Okay, here you go. Here's your number, right? Because what the designers are doing who didn't understand physics are just like, okay, maybe this torque will work. No? Okay, make it twice as big. No, make it 100 times as big, right? And just keep doing that, and sooner or later they get something they like. And that was kind of cool because it's this stochastic process for like finding interesting parameter sets where they would do something and say, oh, that wasn't what I wanted, but that's really cool, so I'll keep that. So it wasn't all bad, but it really was this trial and error thing that I think there's this interactive tool eventually in our future where when you're putting together a machine with physics, you can just grab it and move it and try out all of this stuff and see the numbers that would go into the design interface, because that's really like the more intuitive way for the designers to solve these calculations. You know, think about balancing stuff versus calculating the mass and the distance away, the leverage, right? I think they're just going to do that more intuitively, and I wish we had that interactive tool, and I know there's some plugins that do some of it. So getting that tied more into your design process would be a really interesting thing. So some other technical problems that come up. Now, again, you know, we're transported back to like 1999, and physics has kind of moved forward in a lot of ways since then. So some of the things I'm talking about aren't necessarily a problem depending on which physics technology you use, but I assume some of you guys are building your own physics technology, so it's probably interesting to think about what causes problems with building Half-Life 2. And there's still issues with this kind of stuff, even with more modern physics code. So physics engines usually interact with the game in discrete steps of time, right? You have a time step, and you tell physics, I want to go to the next time step. And changes to the state are usually queued until the next update and step. So that means you say, okay, here's all the game input to this system. Go run physics for a little bit. And then when it gets to the end of that, you say, okay, I'm going to change some things. Go run physics again. And that's not really the model you want when you're doing game design. What you really want is you want to tell the physics, well, run up until the next time there's a collision or some decision or discontinuity going on in the system, and then I want to change the state of stuff, because sometimes I have these rules from the game design that say that things react in this non-physical way, right? And I want to layer those on the simulation right at the point where it happens. But that's really not practical. Like when you look at actually writing a simulator, that's really not a good thing. That makes it a lot harder to do to do high performance physics. So there's a gray area in there, and a balance and a back and forth that has to happen. So I think if someone could design the high-performance system where the game just said, all right, run until the next thing I care about, change state, run until the next thing I care about, everyone would use that. And so until that time, we're living in the technical problem of this. So you want to make a state change, but you've got this latency before it actually happens, and then you want to have something discontinuous, but you don't necessarily get the opportunity to change all the state you'd want at a discontinuity. And so one of the problems we face, which I think should be less of a problem now, is I want to break this object when, you know, if these two objects collide, I want this one to break. But you can only break objects at time steps, right? Because that's like deleting an object or changing collision rules. So you can't just delete it in the middle of a simulation step. And the collisions occur in the middle of a simulation step. So what do you do? So we ended up solving this problem by having the objects bounce off each other, then figuring it out, then moving the one back that doesn't get destroyed and changing its velocity and deleting the other one after the fact and kind of fixing it up. And there are a whole bunch of complexities that come along with that. But what if it hits something else in the same time step that it needed to break as a result of the first collision? You know, what do you want to do? And what if it was in a constraint system, like it's a Jeep, and it's got wheels hanging off of it, and so you move the Jeep back, but what did you do with the wheels? So there are a lot of technical problems coming out of even something simple like that. So another thing is speculation. I mean, we found that we wanted to do a lot of things, like if you have inventory or you're creating objects, you want to make sure that there's space for that in the world, right? And I know lots of other games have encountered this, like the player's holding something that they want to drop or the player has a weapon that creates something. Like we have this with the grenades in Half-Life 2. So, I mean, you can take lots of different approaches. You can say, all right, the player has some bounding volume that's reserved in space, and I'm going to create all my grenades inside that bounding volume, not have collisions with the player, and let them slide out of the bounding volume and go be physical. And that's an okay solution for that particular problem. But there are lots of problems, like in our AI, where you kind of want to do this collision detection without physics, right? And the simple one is just ray tracing. You want to say, hey, can I see, do I have line of sight to that over there? You know, and there are all these physics objects. Or even more complicated one would be, well, what if I wanted to move over there? Would I hit any physics objects? And which ones would I hit? And when? You know, and can I do some motion planning around this by, you know, speculating about how my volume might move through the space? And so that one, I think it's not the only way to do AI, but it was the way our AI worked. And so this was one of the big technical problems, which was how do we put this speculation layer underneath our AI that we have now for things that aren't physics when our physics system doesn't let us do this speculation? And we didn't end up investing in our own in-house speculative collision for that. I think you can buy that now. So we would probably just buy it now if we had to do it over again. But, you know, back then that wasn't available. And you know, you can also design your AI system so that it doesn't need it. And I think that's a valid approach too. But if you're taking all the AI from Half-Life that's working and using it, you know, you don't really want to say, oh, well, let me change this core requirement and redo all the motion planning. So this thing I was getting at before about these layered game design rules and the simulation underneath is really it's what you'd call an overdetermined system, right? You have more variables than you need, and they're all interacting with each other, and what you want is a solution. So you've got the simulation variables from physics, you've got the design variables, you know, the control you're exerting over it, and maybe some rules. And so you can end up with some interesting problems, like this one problem I've heard referred to as the Superman problem. So you give the player an input into the system, and that allows you, for one reason or another, to generate energy, or, you know, impulses in the system that are too large. And we had this with the gravity gun, where you could pick up an object, and we wanted the response to be really stiff, right? So you could spin 180 with the mouse, and we wanted the object to basically follow you. That implied that it was moving at a really high velocity for it to do that. But then if it hit something along the way, we didn't want it to be moving at that high velocity, because then you could hit that thing with a huge impulse, right? And, you know, you could pick up a tin can, and if you spin fast enough, you could knock a car, you know, over with it. And so, hey, the first thing people did with the gravity gun when we got, you know, collisions that caused damage is they pick up a tin can and they run up to the enemies and beat them to death with it, right? So that was kind of funny and cool, but it wasn't really a good game design solution to combat with physics. So what we ended up doing there is there are a combination of things, but the ideal expression of the game design rule, which, again, isn't the only way to solve the problem, but a game designer said, well, just make it make it move really fast so it keeps up with you, but then when it hits something, you know, make physics think it's not moving that fast, right? Say it's moving slow instead. And that actually wasn't easy to do in our physics system, so instead we went into some of the other variables and said, oh, actually, the mass for this thing is really, really low. And so while you're doing the gravity gun thing with it, we constrain the mass and we constrain the velocity so that the product of those two form the constraint on momentum that we want, right? So you can't actually introduce this huge amount of energy. But there are other examples of that if you guys want to go into more of them, I can do that in the Q&A. I guess the one other thing I want to mention is the simulation fails. Objects get stuck in each other. Things don't settle. You have a state that's valid for physics but not valid for game design. Like, you have an object that you said, the game design said it's here, but it's physics, so go there. And the physics tries to go there, but it gets in some collision. It's like, well, I can't actually get there because this other thing is in the way. And game design is assuming, well, no, it got there, right? So, you know, what do you do about that? Occasionally, a simulator would blow up. I mean, usually for us with our simulator, that was a case of us using a really big mass ratio. So you have a giant freight container falling on a traffic cone or something like that, and both of them are rigid. You know, that could produce some problems. And we ended up just compressing the dynamic range of mass and putting a limit on the upper and lower until we got to a point where those mass ratios wouldn't happen. And like I was saying before, I guess there are game design constraints that can't be satisfied. We had a lot of these show up in the player movement where, because of the way our system worked, we wanted to be able to assert that the player movement would move and feel a certain way. We wanted it to feel like Half-Life and not different, you know, not like driving around a little simulated vehicle, which is kind of the easiest thing to do from a physics perspective. And so there are lots of solutions to that, but, you know, it's important that you realize there are going to be game design constraints that can't be satisfied, and you're going to end up creating objects in solid space and having things penetrate in an undesirable way. So I guess the point is, plan for the simulator to fail, know that you have to deal with that, and you end up being a lot happier. If you plan to, like, always get it working so that it can't fail, you're not going to be very happy. So just kind of closing, I want to say, you know, use engineering wherever you can to do your game mechanics. And, you know, I talked about some things I thought were pretty powerful tools. There's a lot of technical problems remaining with integrating physics. I mean, I think, you know, our game totally wouldn't have been possible without the technology that we license. But I think, you know, actually integrating it into our gameplay was a pretty big amount of work, too. And those things are comparable. I mean, I don't really know which one's more work, but, you know, it wasn't like a small amount of work to make it really work with the game. So hopefully, you know, games now have more, a little bit more example solutions to go and follow. But, you know, you should plan on investing in some technology if you're doing, you know, the kind of integration into your gameplay that we're doing. And plan for failure cases. And I guess the other thing is just ask, you know, is this a desirable thing, you know, is the player doing something that's actually desirable to them, or are they just, you know, poking at the simulator? And that was kind of a good roadmap for, like, what do you want to do about it? What are the cases where you can just cheat? So, yeah, now I'd like to open it up for questions if anybody wants to drill into things. And there's a microphone right here to ask them.
Hi, I have a question, one about design and one about the programming. Did you have to deal with physical setups where the player could defeat the setup and then become stuck? And then what was your philosophy about that? And on the technical, did you guys use a fixed time step, and what was the step? And what were the, you know, implications of that?
Okay, so the technical one's really easy. We use a fixed time step of 15 milliseconds. And mostly that had to do with iterations in the Spring controllers or the constraint solvers in terms of how it affected the system. There were a couple of other things with performance tuning, like we had a cap on the number of collisions we would solve in a time step, so you kind of want to tune those things together, but that's not as important. Really, you need to, the time step can go only as low as, like, the constraint solvers and controllers let it. So do we have to deal with cases where the player could get stuck or defeat the system? I mean, yeah, you know, it was possible in Half-Life 2 to get trapped under a really massive object and not be able to move. And so one of the things we did there is actually write a little solver that computes, it does like a static stress analysis. It goes out and looks at your contacts and says, okay, I've got all this incoming you know, force on these contacts. Let me figure out what the stress is on the object, and if the stress gets higher than the threshold under which you can move, the player gets killed. And that actually caused us some problems, because there are cases where the player can defeat that system by, like, making a machine that redirects their own movement force into the stress system, and kind of figuring out how to detect that was a really nasty problem. So I don't know if I'd advocate that as, like, the solution, but it's one we got working well enough to ship. And we still have a bug where there are these dumpsters that you can't move in the prison area, and I'm not sure if we ended up fixing them in place or not, but there was a time when they weren't fixed in place, and an explosion could go off and cause one of those to flip over, and you would be underneath it, unable to actually use the gravity gun to launch it off of you, and stuck inside. And it was just rare enough that I think either we may have filled it with some like player clip invisible thing so that it would stress you or not cover you, and we may have just left it. I don't remember.
I was just curious, during testing and even after the game shipped, what kind of emergent behaviors and fun or bizarre things did you guys experience with, you know, physics? Gamers obviously have crazy ways of making things happen.
Yeah, I mean, there were some really cool things. I mean, you know, on the emergent gameplay side, I mean, we tried to get a lot of playtesting so that we would find enough of the cool stuff out of the player freedom and actually go get intentional about it in the game, right? I mean, I think that's the best kind of emergent gameplay is gameplay that the players sort of find for themselves, but you've got to make sure it's fun because you know they're going to find it. But there were things like, you know, we built the propeller traps that would saw the zombies in half, and some players found out, hey, I don't need the motor on those. I can make those work with the gravity gun, and I can stop them by grabbing them. And they made this weapon out of them and this cool kind of mechanic that we didn't anticipate. So there were definitely things like that. And initially, the turrets were kind of a similar thing of knocking them over with the physics. There were a bunch of things that emerged out of that about carrying them around or carrying shields around that, you know, made it into the game design. Out in the customer base, I mean, there are tons of things. I don't have a lot of good examples off the top of my head, but there were tons of things people surprised us with. I mean, one of them that's a little bit embarrassing is the Superman problem does exist in the game, and there was a way to, by really quickly grabbing and letting go of objects, you could build a bridge on the air and like walk out into space, and people had a lot of fun with that, though. So,
just given the possibility for so many things getting in the player's way, the player getting stuck with that many physical objects, could you really imagine shipping that game without something like the gravity gun?
That's a good question. I mean, we always knew that the player and the AI movement was going to have to deal with all these objects in order to get the experience we wanted, right? And so We launched kind of blindly into all the technical problems with that, and the gravity gun was certainly part of the solution. I think we just wanted to succeed at that. I don't know how else to say that, and did everything necessary to do it. But it's not like we had all the answers to doing that when we started. So that's maybe a good lesson about physics is it ended up being. A lot of the succeeding at some of the stuff like that ended up being, you know, 100 little successes rather than like one big success. You know, like, oh, okay, if I can handle this, and in this case where it breaks, or I can make this thing work better, then we can get to this experience. And then you find three more problems and you solve those, and eventually you get there, but you had to solve like 10 little problems instead of just one big one.
So this is left. Would you care to make any irresponsible speculation about the future of physics in 3D gameplay?
I knew somebody was going to ask me this. I think, you know, I can cop out a little bit and say I think there were some things we learned with the glue gun that make me want to build a game where you do a lot of construction out of physics, and that's really intriguing. I think we've only scratched the surface of what's possible. You know, we just gave you kind of rudimentary player inputs into the system. There's a lot more room in there. We didn't explore that space as much as we could have. I mean, you know, we don't even give you the ability to orient objects or even interact so much with collisions. He's telling me we're out of time, so I guess this is you can be last.
Okay. Was like networking and all of like the multiplayer aspect, like was that accounted for in the early design, or would Well, like, did that come after?
So networking, I think, you know, networking is something we don't have totally solved yet. We do have networking, like, you know, the doors in Counter-Strike are physics, and you can open them, and they simulate on the server, and then that gets replicated over the client, and there's a proxy for it on the client mirroring those motions, and that's like a good general pattern for networking with physics. So we do have a server-side simulation and a client-side simulation, and we are doing the things you want to do with, you know, sharing all the collision model memory, and we do have different rigid body objects in both simulations, so you do end up with some cost there. And I guess the other thing we did is to make sure that you're not calculating collisions on the client for things that have been solved on the server. So that's really important to go and make sure you've thought that out, because otherwise you're just wasting a bunch of CPU. The ragdoll system always supported client or server-side simulation, and we did that with like the breakable objects and all the pieces that came out of those. We made a client and server-side version of that. Most of those things, you know, just about bandwidth. I mean, the ragdoll thing is pretty expensive. We have a few server-side ragdolls. When you run over somebody with the vehicle, you know, we wanted them to pop up on the hood of the vehicle, and so there's like a little bit of code to sort of embellish those collisions, and we solve them server-side, so like the guy's riding on your hood until you stop and he falls off. You know, we wanted to give you that experience in the game. So that stuff gets done server-side, but then when you look at networking all those join angles, it's actually quite a bit of data to do every frame, and you know, you want it to be really high fidelity. So we do network it and then interpolate it, but really it's, you know, it's the bandwidth. You probably almost do a channel of voice for the same amount of bandwidth as one ragdoll until you start quantizing really far on the angles. So it's kind of a tough thing. So I guess I'm going to stop now, but you know, I'll hang around and if people want to drill into something. Thank you.